You are now listening to Out of the Blank.
Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank podcast. Nick, it's nice to meet you. Any friend of David is a friend of mine.
I wouldn't call him a friend, but he's a good guy.
I know. I just assume. I just said Nick. Do you like Nicholas or Nick?
Nick is fine. I always run long story short with Dave. Him and I are in scouts together, or were in scouts together. I'm actually a lot older than he is, and he came into our Boy Scout troop as I was leaving our Boy Scout troop due to aging out. And I've known him for, 15 years now at this point. He's a great guy.
That's all right. Well, you just said for me hit on so many topics. First, you said the aging out part where I was like, that's so strange. Imagine like dedicating your whole life to a group. And then next thing you know, you're like, oh, you're too old to be in this group. It's like, what?
Well, I'm still involved with them, technically. I shouldn't say technically. I am still involved as an adult leader. But it's going from being a youth to an adult. That's when you say age out, it means you're just no longer able to earn requirements, badges, obtain the rank of Eagle. Now you're an adult leader.
What made you decide to join those?
I joined Cub Scouts in like the mid 90s, I want to say, as a wolf, like the youngest you can join, and been a part of it ever since. It's a really great organization, wilderness survival, self-reliance, leadership, kind of developing all those different kind of skills like communication, managing your finances, how to vote, and what it means to be a citizen. Like all those different kind of parts of humanity. I guess being an American or really a citizen of the world, because scouting is not just a United States thing. There are scouts in Europe, Asia, throughout Africa, like all over the world. And it's a fantastic organization.
I was never a fan, I think, of it only on the concept of wearing a uniform. I worked a casino job where I was a security guard. I'd never liked the whole tuck your shirt in type style. You have to make sure your attire is all good. But I enjoyed the camping aspect to a lot of it, which is why I just decided I didn't join it, but I went into my own like camping all the time, doing that 24/7. There's just something primal about being in the middle of the woods. Like there's a picture on the internet talking about like guys will just stare into a fire and then just get something from it. Like there's just hours of just countless staring into a fire. I'm like, I don't know what it is. Is it murder? No, but it's enticing to look at a flame or just even be out in the middle of the woods and just feel like you're kind of isolated a bit, like not having cell phone reception. At times it has its importance.
It's peaceful. A couple weeks ago we were at summer camp and my fiance had never been because there was the pandemic last year, so there was no summer camp. And the year before that it just couldn't line up, and we met a month after camp, 3 years ago. Our anniversary is tomorrow. Tomorrow when we're recording this, I'm not sure when this airs. So I had her like come down. She's like, it's so dirty. There's like sticks everywhere. And I was, first of all, I laugh at her because she immigrated from the Dominican when she was 14. So I'm like, I don't know. You tell me all the time that your family moved to like the country in the Dominican like years before you guys came to the United States. So what was it like in the country of the Dominican like back then? Like it probably was just like this. I guess it's just remembering it differently. But I always tease her about that. But I had her like, look, this is the bunk. Just sit, like lay down here, put your head on the pillow, and just don't talk for like 1 minute. And she, like, because there's this nice little breeze that comes through. It's in the shade. You hear like some like the birds. It is pretty nice. I could probably take a nap right now.
It's good for the first couple of hours that you're there, and then you start to see how it gets a little bit annoying when you wake up the next day and you smell like a campfire. Like that's the big thing, is like you got to make sure you got a shower. And then even doing that, if you go to a campground or something, if you're going to shower, their showers aren't the best. So you're probably not going to shower. At least I never did there. I waited till I got home. But it's that feeling like when you're in it, you're getting all dirty. There's just something about it that's like you don't notice it. And then when you go home to your nice clean house, you're like, oh, shit. Like I can feel like there's just a layer of filth on me that you don't really recognize. And it makes you kind of question of like, how much can you survive like without like in your life right now? What is the basic things that you could rule out to get you to more of a calm and peaceful state? Because the only times I find that I'm ever really truly immersed into something is when I truly isolate myself from the phone, from the networks, from just, I mean, it's a whole, you don't realize it because of how fun it is. Like I'm playing Dragon City and I'm spending like hundreds and hundreds of dollars just buying random gem packs. But then without my phone and I'm just sitting outside in the sun, I live in a beach town. So if I want to go to the beach or something, the time goes by like it's nothing.
Oh yeah. I feel that, like it's, you know, kind of like getting further into the stuff, you know, I run the blog and Instagram account, The Drinking Lawyer. So I, you know, obviously you can't drink at summer camp because, you know, of all the regulations that come with it. And realistically, you should never do that in front of kids. And I'm an attorney, so I have to work and be next to my cell phone or a computer or have an internet connection just for day-to-day life for work. So it's nice to unplug for a little bit. But based upon my lifestyle, I could never do that for anything longer than 2 weeks.
What made you decide that you wanted to become a lawyer?
That's a funny story. The Spark Notes version of it was I was a smart ass kid and would question things constantly and would always kind of fight and kind of claw for that, either the little guy or if I didn't think something was right. And anytime, like, well, I'm the teacher. I'm like, well, what does that mean? Like, that doesn't mean anything to me. And I finally got a teacher in like the fifth grade. Like, you'd make a pretty good lawyer, who kind of recognized my spunkiness / I know that was a fun conversation from a few weeks ago about the word spunk with one of your other friends.
Yeah.
And me being a punk for like, no, like you're actually like smart and capable and let me find a proper outlet for you. I'm like, why don't you be a good lawyer? I'm like, what's a lawyer? And then the rest was set. To me, the thing I love the most about it is because I love puzzles and problem solving and just thinking through things. Someone comes to you with a problem and the only way you can solve that problem is with your mind and your creativity. So I was like, that's just a really cool thing to do. And like every so often I have times where like I dislike certain parts of the profession and things like that, but I could never not be a lawyer. Like, it's so much fun.
It's for me, like I remember someone telling me that I'd make a good lawyer. And I was like, I might be argumentative. I don't know if that's a compliment to that, but I just, it's so hard because it does turn into like I've talked about before, a bit of a game. Like it's, there's gotta be a winner. There's gotta be a loser, obviously. Yeah. So they can rule out a decision. But then it's like, how many court cases I've read based on the fact of like someone manipulating evidence or manipulating, it's kind of like a smooth talking in a way. Like if you're able to like, I don't know if you saw the Derek Chauvin case when they were doing the trial and everything like that, there was like an ending testimony from either side that sounded like I was watching fucking Law and Order on television. I was like, is this a movie? Like, and they try and sway it. And it's like, you could tell when someone really packs a wallop with the fucking speech that they give. Cause they're like, and then they took his last breath. And then it's like, what the fuck? Just, this is a serious issue. And you just gave me like a line that I would see Kevin Bacon read to me, which is like fucking nuts to me. How like, if you look at these court cases and stuff, it's all like, what can someone do to either hide some evidence or make sure that point doesn't get out? They can steer the question around. That's what I like, is like the linguistical programming and the language that they use to be able to like sway a juror's opinion or sway a certain type of thing, or even pull out a message.
So I mean, you know, have you ever seen The Wire? I know you know, you're a little bit younger, so.
No.
All right. So The Wire was this, again, it took me a while to see it. It was a show on HBO back in like the early 2000s, like around the time of The Sopranos, like one of the best shows out there. And one of the characters played by Michael K. Williams, Omar, has this great line. Like, I think it's at the end of season one. Because it's about like drug trade in Baltimore, and he always says like, you know, it's just the game, it's just all in the game. And they close out season one with him like holding somebody up like, just relax baby, it's all in the game. And that's how the season ends. I say that I used to say it not when I was in the office a bunch, because it was just, I was playing to a crowd because it was just all people hanging around, not hanging around, but working near me and like other attorneys or paralegals. So I always, you know, would say something kind of funny just because I like telling jokes and it helps to break up the day. But I was just like, it's all in the game, baby. It's all in the game. And they're like, what do you mean? It's all like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you know, has no one seen The Wire? Watch The Wire. It's fantastic.
There's just so many like cases where like, it's about like some people, like for instance, a perfect example would be like, there's some people we've probably come across in our everyday life. They're like, this is something about the look of this person I really like, or something about them. That's the same thing kind of with the juror when they're looking at, like, as soon as they come in the court case before anything even starts, the jury is already looking over like, he looks like a good person, or he looks like this, or they're already making base decisions off of appearances. And then you get deeper into the thing. You might have a side that's right. You might be fighting against a giant tobacco company and trying to rule out all the issues that they might have cut some corners or something with doing business to be able to get their product out there. But they're looking at the person that was hired to be on the opposing team. It's kind of like How I Met Your Mother, where they do the court case and the dude comes in, the guy with the six pack who plays in Magic Mike or whatever, and he's all like super handsome. And then there's, you know, what's I'm blanking
Jason
on
Siegel.
Jason or, Siegel.
Marshall.
Yeah, Marshall. So he comes in and he's just a big oaf looking character. And even the sketch artist drew him like an oaf in a suit compared to the handsome. And it's like, that's exactly how it is. Sometimes you can manipulate by using whatever. And I'm not against, if you have a tactical advantage, sure. But I look at it like, there used to be an old project back in the day called Truth Wizards. And you can actually test online for this too. I don't know how, it's kind of like checking your horoscope. I wouldn't take it at face value, but it's more like back in the day, they used to appoint people that could kind of sense out bullshit if someone was like, you know, a little bit, which you have to kind of have when you're a cop, when you're a judge, when you're a lawyer. You have to tell if someone's giving you a full, like a full script, or if they're doing something where they're lying and hiding up something, so you can be able to rule out what the truth is. Necessarily, that's not really it anymore. Now it's like, it became this. Back in the day, there was a rising trend of what it means to be successful. And what it means to be successful means that you had to get a degree, you had to go be a doctor, or you had to be in law or a judge or a lawmaker or a cop. It's not really like that anymore. I mean, I'm seeing a kid that YouTube Twitch streams and he's making like $1 million. I'm like, what the fuck? He's just playing his day in his Snapchat story. It was a story about this kid. He goes, well, I wake up at 7 a.m., I do an hour of Twitch streaming, and then I spend about 5 or 6 hours just playing games and streaming. It's a rough day. People don't know how exhausting it is. And I'm like, I get that, but still, at the same time, you're comparing yourself to like a woodsman who's cutting fucking wood in the middle of Canada for $5 an hour, or a Looney Toonies, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, there was, I forget, it was a stand-up comedian like years ago. I wish I could remember who it was, but he had this really great joke about how he was like working in this office job. Like, it was brand new, and like one of his coworkers comes up and was like, hey, whatever. I like to work hard and play hard. What about you? And he just like looked at him and was like, no, dude, like, what do you work 45 hours a week and then go split a pitcher of Miller Lite with like your three coworkers? That's not working hard and playing hard. Working hard and playing hard is a guy on an oil rig who's out there working, you know, 48 of 72 hours, makes 40 grand, comes back to shore and spends it all on drugs, women, and alcohol. That's a guy who works hard and plays hard.
Yeah, they wonder why, like, if they do a percentage test of how many people are drinkers or people that use drugs or people that do, like, some things that aren't really seen good in the eyes of the public, they're working stressful-ass jobs or their life situation isn't exactly the best. It's like, yeah, after a long week of, like, I don't know, working in a warehouse and stocking shelves for, like, $10 an hour – yeah, I mean, if you're working 70 hours or something like that, next thing you know, you wonder why the person's an alcoholic, is because he just wants to go home, drink because he's miserable.
One of the worst things about law school, aside from being law school, is orientation. And I remember because I went to Suffolk University in Boston. I graduated in 2015. So I've only been practicing for about 4.5 years now at this point. I took the bar in 2016, failed the first time, passed the second time. So, you know, anyone out there who is studying for the bar, or, you know, just took the bar last week, and I'm not sure if any of your listeners do that, but
I don't know if my listeners are in law school, but let's hope.
Very quickly, if you are, and you didn't pass the first time, don't worry about it. You know, take a minute, take a week after you get the results, decompress, take that bad news, and then reapply and get right back into it. you'll kill yourself. You'll hate yourself forever if you don't do it, first and foremost.
First off, I want to thank you for thinking that someone that's a lawyer is going to listen to my show on the daily basis. But just kids saying some great stuff.
Well, hopeful. Yeah, I did, and I do. So, I mean, hopefully there's more than one of us. But one of the things they talk to you about during your orientation, and on one of the Instagram accounts I follow, was talking, like, had this really great compare and contrast from, like, law school to med school. And in med school, it's like first day of med school, it's like, you know, you are all smart, beautiful individuals who are going to change the world and make everybody great again. And I was like, first day of like law school, it's like, you suck. You were all stupid for doing this. The three of you who passed are going to work for horrible corporations and just ruin everything for everyone. And I was like, yeah, kind of pretty similar. Like every so often, like you'll have a professor like, yeah, like, you know, why'd you even decide this? Like lawyer, like law is like a horrible profession to get into. Because what they do, and one of the things they kind of talk about is like how, like, you know, look to your left, look to your right, one of you is going to be an alcoholic. I'm like, come on, really?
Jesus.
Like that's orientation. And like, cause like health and wellness and benefits. And I always think, and one of the reasons, cause I always say, like, you know, tell people like, don't be a lawyer, cause it's really, really hard. And it's really, really terrible to me. Cause that's what people told me. And I was like, okay, I'm still going to do it. If you were committed enough, because law school, it's hard. It's a 3-year grind of reading case law, reading treatises to understand your case law, and then reading more case law to understand the treatises to understand the case law. So you'd get like a 10-page reading assignment in law school. That's like 3 cases long. Outline the cases, notarize, like read up the cases. And then at the end of each case, there are a bunch of like note cases. A good example, just like in first year torts, talking about, actually, no, that's a poor example. I'll do contracts. This is how you break a contract. This is the correct way to break a contract. And then below there are a bunch of reasons why it's okay to break this contract based upon this circumstance and then that circumstance and then this, another circumstance there afterwards. So there's one case with 3 or 4 cases below it, you should read. So right there's 5 cases. Multiply that by, you know, 2 more cases, so 3 cases, 5 note cases below it, that's 15 cases. Read your treatise, which outlines breaking cases, not breaking cases. Then that's another like 50 pages of reading. And then add on more reading about other case law that you might need to know about, then that's like probably it's 120 pages. And that's just one subject. Yeah. So it's tough. And it's not just about being smart. It's about hard work and being determined and going through it and failing. Because in law school, you're graded on a curve. So you have to beat people, which is why, like, you know, you see movies like Paper Chase and Legally Blonde to a certain degree, which is 2 way opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to the legal movies, how like people in like those top tier law schools and other law schools get super competitive and like give you false information. Luckily, I didn't have that at Suffolk. You know, we're not like a top tier law school, but we're like a very good blue collar pragmatic law school where like everyone kind of works together a little bit. Every so often you get somebody, the slang is gunner, where you just run out to try to, you know, be the best, you don't really care what. But those people usually flame out halfway through the year because they're just so tired and exhausted. But lost my train of thought exactly where that came from. But with the profession and how hard it is, there's a lot of people who flame out and stop. And like kind of like all of that stress and hard work. And obviously what I do is, you know, what lawyers do is significantly different than like a guy who's welding, you know, crawling on his back at 100 degrees, like, you know, with sparks flying in his face. You know, I guess maybe the more progressive side of me, I'm not here to work shame or like hard work is hard work, depending upon what it is, because I remember playing video games for 6 hours and I remember being like dead tired afterwards.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't call that necessarily hard work, but to them it might be.
Well, to every job probably has its own unique kind of effects to it, or draining mentalities, for instance, like physical, I would say drains, and then mental drains. Mental drains are more when you're working with the law, or you're trying to read over documents, and you're trying to see and scrape over every single word. There's it's, I guess it has to be so tough only on the factor of you have to make sure that you can last out in court. There's a person named Phil Demers who's been in a lawsuit for 9 years with a place called Waterworld that me and David talked about on his first episode. It's basically like this, like SeaWorld, but in Canada. But in Canada, there's no laws or rules that say you can't just have a dolphin in your backyard. So it's kind of like in Texas, there's no limit or number of tigers that you can have. So you can just own a shit ton of tigers. It's not illegal. Tiger King kind of highlighted that a little bit. But in Canada, they can have dolphins in a swimming pool in their backyard if they wanted to. There's no law or anything that abides them from not doing that. So this guy just created this water park, or this water world, sea world type scenario, and just flooded it with all these marine animals. And then he doesn't take care of them. They're all like going through severe health issues. This guy exposed a lot of the stuff that was going on there. Now they're suing him, and it's been going on for 9 years. And he's like, they're trying to outlast me. And it's like, that's kind of what you have to do. If you have the money for it, it's all about winning by like just keeping it going on. If they're not going to reach a settlement or something like that, like what in your mind, for instance, or what have you experienced court case wise that has been like the worst thing you've ever experienced?
I will say that is one of the things I do dislike about the profession, the quote unquote war of attrition in litigation. Now, I'm licensed to practice in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, so I can really only answer Rhode Island, Mass type of law questions and kind of be as vague as possible, thanks to privilege. But in Rhode Island, and it's something I tell clients all the time, and it is really unfortunate because we have a massive backlog of cases, even before COVID, where I always tell my clients, like, if you file the lawsuit, you won't get a jury trial until like 5.5-6 years from now. Like, that's when your court date will be. And we always say, kind of like in our kind of the profession, cases settle, like, especially I practice personal injury. They'll settle because Rhode Island is very plaintiff friendly, because there's like statutory interest that attaches from the day of the incident through a jury decision or through a court decision. So it's, you know, 12% per annum, which means, you know, 1% a month. So like if a case goes on for 3 years, that's 36% interest on top of whatever you get. So it's, you know, very helpful for plaintiffs. And harmful for, you know, defense and insurance companies to like take a case to trial. They only take cases to trial where they know they're going to win, or they know that the interest isn't going to kill them. Usually they'll try to settle. They'll try to like break that middle ground. Sometimes, yeah, I've been on cases, and another thing that I like greatly dislike, it's lawyers who intentionally ask a misleading question. Not that they're being untruthful or trying to get a lie out, or trying to telling a story that's not correct, telling a story that is correct, but through their perspective. My fiance, and I've said, teased her about this a few times. She's like, well, the truth is the truth. Like, there's nothing that's different about it. And I always play this game. It's like, well, I always say the truth is subjective, because, and this is why people hate lawyers. It's like, no, but the truth, it's honesty. It's like, okay, well, is my shirt white or is it not black? Like outside right now, is it sunny or is it just not cloudy? My walls, are they gray or not red? And that's what attorneys do. And I, like I said, that's one of the reasons people hate lawyers. And one of the things I dislike about the profession, because it's that I don't want to say unscrupulous, but not being dedicated to the stone cold facts that are being outlined. And I had a client who was Spanish speaking, and it was a weird kind of case about, like, you know, a left hand turn and stopping, not stopping. And they were fighting, the defense was fighting, because they didn't speak English, and their English wasn't, you know, or their English wasn't super great, and they weren't, you know, well educated, unfortunately. And getting them to second guess and question their story. And it was like, you know, it was a non-binding statutory arbitration. Usually these take half an hour tops. And this guy questioned this person for like, I want to say 20 minutes. And asking some like the silliest, stupidest questions, like would take it forwards to the turn, come back to before the turn, take it past the turn, come back, like get intentionally trying to confuse them about their story because they didn't, the defense attorney didn't believe them. And not because, and again, I could never prove it because of whatever reason, but they didn't believe them because I'm guessing they just looked at them and kind of to your point from earlier about how people make appearances, they just thought that they were in this to get a to get a quick buck, which is another thing I very much dislike are the people who try to make this tiny little thing into this massive, massive, massive case. Because to me, again, as a personal injury attorney, I see it every day where like there's a paint chip on the back of your car and my, you know, the client in their mid 30s, like, oh my God, I'm never gonna be the same again. I'm like, you're gonna be fine. Go to the physical therapist, go to the doctor, you'll be okay. And then every so often, because you know, we have a lot of cases in our firm, the same collision will happen and it'll be a older person, you know, past medical history of like issues. I had a case where they had no neck issues beforehand, but they were holding the cell phone like this, got rear-ended, and had this really nasty neck injury. And I remember being up like negotiating that case and the adjuster's like, I don't like, there's no way. Like look at the damage, there's no way. I'm like, well, if you listen to what I'm saying, like it makes sense. Like this is what it says in the medical records. All throughout the medical records, it talks about this. Nah, I just don't believe it. I just don't believe it, just don't believe you. To me that, I don't know what's worse. They're both equally bad, but I don't think there's one that I hate more of like an attorney deliberately being misleading or like deliberately asking questions that are, you know, to get at a point that he wants or they want, or the people who make collisions out to be like their own personal moneymaker because it cheapens the people who are seriously injured, severely disabled, because it's just really tough for them. And they ruin it for everybody for the most part. They think that the people who think that a rear end collision is a blank check to, you know, redo their bathroom. Those are the people I really, really dislike. But when it comes to that, yeah, I would say that's probably one of the more things I dislike of the profession is those type of people.
I respect it and I hate it. I've had a personal case with me trying to get a medicine, going through medical priority partners ended up denying me for this medication that I needed. And I spent almost 2 years trying to get it. Then I finally get the court appointment during like COVID. So it was a Zoom call. They missed 5 times. And I was like, if I would have missed once, that would have been it. Like there would have been no retrial. There would have been nothing. But since this company, I was like, and it's priority partners, like that's nothing. And the guy, the Judge Osborne, goes, no, it's not Priority Partners. It's John Hopkins. And my face fucking dropped because I was like, geez, I didn't even come in here with a lawyer. I'm sitting in my podcast studio in a fucking Zoom call wearing like a light blue shirt. I look like a fresh faced child. And he goes, yeah. And then I ended up winning because they ended up like blanking out a bunch of stuff. They apologized and everything and all the hate went away. But yeah, it's more of like how long of a pursuit it took when there's probably someone in that same exact scenario. And the judge put it to me best. He goes, they just read off a piece of paper and they read some key details. They don't see your face. They don't know what you're going through. They don't know any of this stuff. And they stamp yes or no. And I was like, okay, that puts it in a better perspective. I kind of have less hate for them now. But it's like, how many people really need something and they can't get it, all in the factor of how kind of screwed up the court system is a little bit when it comes to the fact that a lot of these things get sitting and waiting for 10, 15 years when someone doesn't even have a chance to be able to pursue it that long.
The tricky part, and I mean, like I said, I can only speak to Rhode Island and Mass. Massachusetts has a somewhat better system in some ways. And so, there's what's called Superior Court and then District Court. And it's a class you take, and I had to take it in law school about the different courts that you can file in. A district court versus a superior court versus like a city court. And certain courts have, you know, jurisdiction. It comes up all the time. You probably hear it. Like federal jurisdiction versus state jurisdiction is probably the better way to like imagine it. Like how, like there's some things that are like a question of federal law versus a question of state law and like the courts that can or should hear that. But each state has its own authority to discuss or to kind of dictate matters. Now, Massachusetts through, again, district court and superior court, district court is limited to cases worth $50,000 or less. So if your case is worth less, you can file in district court and it moves a lot quicker. It's only about a year to 2 years now. It used to be under a year before COVID. And that it's affectionately called the Rocket Docket. Defense attorneys hate it. And that's probably why you see cases and, you know, another, again, I don't, can't speak with any real authority, just as a blanket assumption, you know, defense attorneys bill for insurance companies. They bill for corporations. They bill for other companies. They bill in, you know, their time and they can probably, you know, get their way to lobby. The longer a case goes, the more you have time for what's called discovery, where you sit for interrogatories, depositions, discovery production requests, coordinated next arbitrations, mediations, all these different things. And all the meantime, you're sitting there, telling a story, the same story, over and over and over again. And the more you tell the story, the more chances you have to kind of mess it up a little bit. And no matter how well you're prepped by somebody like me or another attorney, you're going to make a mistake at some point. And that's when the attorneys kind of pounce. So I do hope, and I think at some point, Rhode Island, again, it's a 6-year wait right now for a jury trial. Most people, again, most cases settle before they get there. But eventually, like, it's going to be kind of like a tipping point, almost like a bubble, where you get this thing and it's just so unruly and ungodly large where it's going to pop and you're going to have this situation with all these different plaintiffs in litigation and not have a situation. Or even worse, or better for plaintiffs, worse for other people. And this happened in Massachusetts where a insurance company, and I don't know the specifics, this is a story I heard like second or third hand, an insurance company was caught intentionally withholding evidence. They were caught withholding evidence, intentional, unintentional, whatever it was, because just how plaintiffs have a lot of cases, you know, there's only so many lawyers and so many firms. Like I said, I'm only licensed in Rhode Island and Mass, so I can't take on a Connecticut case, and a defense attorney theoretically can't take on a Connecticut defendant. You can be admitted briefly for one matter. It's called being admitted pro hoc vice, because lawyers are so pretentious, we have to name everything in either Latin, French, or some other language. You can be admitted just for one instance, but you have to have another attorney from that state as your kind of like ride-along partner.
So in the movie Ted, when they go and get Morgan Freeman out of their state as a lawyer or to represent them, that's bullshit?
Well, we don't know if Morgan Freeman's admitted in Massachusetts or not. It never really says. Some people, and this is getting way into the weeds about Ted too, most people back in the day, I mean, probably when Morgan Freeman's character was admitted to the bar, you could take the Rhode Island bar exam and the Massachusetts, no, I'm sorry, the Rhode Island bar, geez, the New York bar exam and the Massachusetts bar exam together. You could burn a path on I-90 in Massachusetts from Worcester to Albany and sit for both bar exams. Now it's a little bit different. It's called the UBE, and we can talk about that at my next appearance, because we got a bunch of other things I want to get through too. I'm already booking number two here, so sorry about that.
I like it. It means you're having fun.
Exactly. But to get back to that point, this company didn't disclose evidence when they were supposed to. Plaintiff's counsel figured it out, knew about it, trapped, and this is again all in the game, trapped defense counsel into this, answer. And this is where the beauty of Massachusetts law comes in. They have what's called 93A. Essentially, it's the don't be a dick clause. You have to be truthful in your negotiation, truthful in your deliberations, and you can't withhold evidence. You can't mislead. You can't mislabel things. And you can't force someone to file a frivolous lawsuit, which I use all the time.
Does anybody expect people to follow those rules, like to not be manipulative? Yeah. Like people don't do that.
Oh yeah, in court you have to. Once you file a complaint, and this is kind of what I was saying about how you can mislead, but you can't lie. It's called Rule 11. It's in federal rules of evidence and in civil procedure. If you deliberately or even unintentionally lie in court, in a court document, you can be sanctioned as a lawyer and potentially disbarred.
You just say, I don't recall.
Yeah. No. You can say, I don't recall. And that's not a lie. Or like you can have the plaintiff or a defense or whomever say either they don't know or they don't remember. But if you can get caught, let's say, to use an example, I put A as my answer, but realistically it's B. And either my plaintiff did it knowingly and told me it was B, or told me it was A and told me it was B and I lied and put A, or I should have known that it was A, but he told me B anyways. That could be, technically speaking, a Rule 11 sanction. Now, you can fight it and you can argue it. Again, that's in like the most simplest terms you can put things. But there's a
just so I make sure I'm understanding this perfectly. When a lawyer says to someone like their defendant or whoever they're they're talking to or trying to defend to make sure they don't get like a sentence and they're trying to say that they're not guilty, don't tell me anything like that. I don't want to know that. As I've heard plenty of defendants say, I don't want to know that. I want to know this. And it makes you think, are they saying something that has nothing to do with the case? Or are they saying something that actually, because when you're a lawyer, especially if it's something that's you're defending somebody, you want to kind of know the truth in a way. You want to know what the scenario is. But at the same time, if they start saying, I did do this, but then this happened, and it was all these other things, you're like, that's going to mess with my head because I'm now going into the case knowing this. And I'm going to be thinking, oh my God, the person I'm trying to get not guilty is actually guilty.
So at a certain point I only practice civil. I don't do criminal. And that's kind of where the stop talking comes in. Because of Rule 11, as I know something, I can't go into court and say the opposite. Again, I can't, if the answer is A, if the answer is B, and I go into court and say the answer is A, I've committed a Rule 11 violation and you'll get caught. That's the easiest, you have to tell the truth in court, especially when you're a lawyer, because it's kind of going back with, the truth is subjective, but if there's a definitive answer and you give the incorrect answer knowingly, it's wrong and it's a violation. But that's kind of, I know you get a little into the political. I used to be political. I've gotten way out of it because I just got sick of it. But with Trump's lawyers, when they were talking about election fraud, listen to the court documents and the court reportings, because there was one of them, and I can't remember where I heard it from, but it was one of the funniest court answers I ever heard. The judge was trying to get to the point, and the defense attorney again was dancing, trying to appease the client, trying to, you know, make their points. And then the judge is just like, oh, like the judge finally said, you know, was there someone from team like represented Donald Trump's interests in the county area? Yes. And it's like, okay, why am I here? Like, what is your violation? What is your accusation? And it's like, that's, and just kind of kept dancing. Well, you know, we think and we feel like, no, that's not what we're here for. That's not what I'm asking you. This is the facts. Like, what is it? And again, lawyer has to say, yeah, we had somebody in there. But that's kind of, once you're in court and once you're in that process, like I said, like that, in that discovery process, where you're answering questions, answering claims, making what's called a good faith complaint, a good faith claim. I can't, if I were to file a lawsuit or to sign a complaint that said, I want the flying spaghetti monster removed from the Rhode Island state capitol.
Hell no, that's Pastafarianism. We're not going down that rabbit hole.
But just as like a silly thing, like a court would look at me, look at the complaint, and the defense attorney for the state of Rhode Island would look at this, dismiss it on another motion. I think it's 12B6 for, you know, failure to state a claim, and then turn around and file Rule 11 motion against me, because it's like, this is the most obtuse, a ridiculous thing. We're not going to get into the existence of a flying spaghetti monster on this, because that's way too deep for, you know, a Monday morning. But there's no way to remove him from the Capitol. Like, what are you even talking? So that it's something like that, where being truthful, being open, and as an attorney, as a client, as a plaintiff defendant, that's perjury. That's a little bit different. Whether or not someone wants to bring perjury charges against you, that's a horse of another color. But as the lawyer, like, it's very serious. And when it's one of the things where when you're a lawyer in court or in the discovery process, you're telling the truth. Like, you can't lie. You can posture, and you can, like, outside of like court documents, talk to defense counsel, like, look, well, I'm gonna try to argue this, like, you know, let's see if we can try to work through this. But once you're in those four walls of litigation, of court documents, of like being in discovery or in the courtroom, you can't lie or fib or even over exaggerate. You have to be in this tight little box, and going outside of it is deadly for you as an attorney, and especially for your case, which is why, you know, they try to, and kind of getting back to my other point, because I went way off the rails on that one. No, you're about that, but I want to make sure I don't lose you too much here in the weeds, with how long things take. When you kind of get back to it, I can't remember if it was an insurance company or some other thing, but they withheld this evidence. The plaintiff's county found it, hit them with this 93A violation, which again, in Massachusetts you have. And the best part about 93A, it's triple damages. So whatever you get as an award, you then find if there's a 93A violation, and whatever the award is, you get triple those damages. So just to kind of make things easier for everybody, 93A, like I said, it's misleading. Classic example is you go to a store in Massachusetts, you see on the display apples for $1. You go to the register, they say, no, apples are $2. That's a 93A violation. It's a small one, but technically speaking, it's a 93A violation. You can get triple damages on your $1 mislead, $3. That no one would ever file that lawsuit. It's stupid and a waste of time. But that's the kind of the best way in your head to
envision it. That's what you say, is nobody would file a lawsuit over $3, but I bet you there's plenty of people that have filed out there for less.
Probably, but like, no, like, attorney would look at you and like, this is a waste of my time.
It's the principle, damn it.
Yes, it is. But like, a person would do that, and then probably, you'd probably settle that case. So what is happening now, insurance companies have so many cases, and defense, they have so many cases. You can only bill so much and have so much in-house counsel before you realize that you have 100, 200 files and something gets missed. And if you miss that, and in litigation, a plaintiff counsel figures out you missed that. Another great example, are you familiar with the Duke Grape case at all? The mm-hmm. lacrosse team? That's another thing. Long story short, without getting too much into it, a woman accused three lacrosse players of rape, played for Duke back in like 06. And through extensive discovery, and criminal discovery works a lot different than civil discovery. Criminal discovery, you have to disclose everything as a prosecution officer or as an officer of the court, because you do all the investigation for the most part. You're the one who has the police force, who has this massive investigatory tool. And what happened was they found that the woman who accused the female cross players of rape had a DNA test, had a rape kit done on her. And again, this could be its own episode entirely, but what happened was the rape kit was done, DNA was taken, and none of it was from the three lacrosse players. The prosecution buried that in their discovery dump, and a attorney for the defense, like through like a couple days before, like weeks before trial, like pouring through like hundreds of pages of like discovery, like sleeping in his office, found it buried in the file that it existed. Went to the bar association, brought it up at trial, brought it up with the defense, questioned the state's medical examiner about it. Medical examiner has to say, like, yeah, like there's no way that their semen was in this DNA. Whether to say they actually did or didn't, that didn't factor into the discovery at that point. It was just whether or not their semen, their DNA, was in the woman when she, you know, after she alleged the rape allegations. The prosecution dropped the case, and I think that lawyer got disbarred for withholding evidence or like dumping it in such a misleading manner where you like I'm trying to think of the word, I can't think of it off the top of my head. That's such probative evidence to be withheld or not withheld, but like hidden in that way is a prosecution attorney using their discretion and like you can like putting not just their thumb, but their entire like arm on the scale of justice. And that's the worst thing. And bar associations, bar committees despise that. Like, you know, even though like you're innocent until proven guilty, and it's such a high burden bar for the prosecution to clear, they want to make sure that stays relevant, that stays as the bar of justice, and that a person walking into a courtroom, the prosecution with their entire army has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, and not cheating, not extending their reach or withholding things or misleading things or hiding things. If as a prosecution attorney, as a, you know, ADA, DA, or attorneys general, you know, they would, I mean, again, I've thankfully never been before the disciplinary committee, but if that were to happen, also I'm not a prosecution attorney, I'm just a plaintiff's attorney. I work for a private firm doing plaintiff's work. They would literally throw the book at you. Not like figuratively, like, oh, like they'd probably actually throw a treatise at you. Like, what are you, stupid? Well, like, you know, why would you do this?
As important as the competition aspect is to make people like to weed out the weak or make, you know, make sure the strong are the ones that are dealing with these heavy issues, I would say, the issue is when you make it a competition thing, you already have wins and losses. If a person has 7 wins on their record of cases that they've won and they've never had a loss, you know, they're going to do anything to try and prevent that loss. Yeah. And sadly, image is everything. I mean, there was a, what is it? The Crucible, that old tale about the guy, the priest that was lying to a bunch of people. And he didn't want people to know about like all the crazy stuff that he did. To all these horrible acts against women or something. And he's about to be hung. And they're like, if you just tell the truth, you know, it's not, you're not going to die. And he's like, nope. And he just kept his mouth shut and they hung him. And it's like, cause he didn't want his image to be soiled. You know, yeah. That's the whole aspect of with lawmaking, or not even with lawmaking, just anything in our court system. It's the whole aspect of like bravado of like, I have this record. It's not even, there's no blemish on it. You'll do anything to try and prevent a loss, or you'll do anything to try and prevent anything that would ruin your record or tarnish it in such a way that would pass up money. And it all goes back to the money thing. And I'm sitting over here, like there's a, I don't know. You look like a fan of Barstool Sports. I mean, most people are.
Yeah, that's actually really funny. I've actually been a Stoolie since like 2009. Like, wait, since I was in college. Not so, to date myself here, but I'm in my 30s now, so I'm pretty old.
You look great. I was right about the Barstool thing. But Barstool, for instance, like I'm a fan of the pizza review things. But I saw James Porteous, whatever his name was, that was in he was in the court case that he had against Michael Rappaport. Michael Rappaport was suing him because he had put Michael Rappaport's face with like what looked to be herpes on a T-shirt and submitted it. And during the court case, he chose to defend himself. And the court's like, so you already have this pre-planned? Like, this was all this? He goes, no, I never had it pre-planned. And they played a bunch of recording calls. And you see, like, he looks like he's like on meth, like Portnoy's like moving back and forth because he knows he's caught, but somehow he got off not guilty because he's somehow like very good, smooth talker, very convincing person. Was like, no, I said, yeah, when we release it after he does that, if he does, it was a backup plan. He started the first move and they're like, okay, you got us there. But you just see him like, he's a bit lying. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that at all. And then they play the recording. He's like, okay, well, what do you got on there? You got nothing. It's like, oh my God, dude, the amount of manipulation in this shit. If I was a juror, I'd be like, both of you are going to fucking jail. How about that? Well, it was over a car accident. Doesn't fucking matter. I hate you both.
So the only reason I know this is because I've been following Barstool against for years. And I remember that whole story, the whole situation. So actually it should, I don't think he wasn't defending himself because what you saw when you're referencing is his deposition. And in his deposition, and also another one of them, Barstool Smitty, Adam Smith, he had an even funnier one where his attorney, and this is actually, I would actually reference this back to the attorney Rappaport's lawyers. Now, again, I don't know what they were doing or what the discovery entailed or any of those things, or I don't even know what the complaint was, if I'm being completely honest. I just think it was something specific to slander or I really don't know, so I can't speak to the
good old Michael Rappaport lost his shit like he does in a lot of the videos that he has, started screaming and cursing and calling out Portnoy, calling him a piece of shit and all this stuff, and then Portnoy's like, okay, I'm gonna release this shirt, and it had Michael Rappaport's face on it with herpes.
Right. I'm just saying, like, I can't, like, the merits of Rappaport's complaint, like how I was saying, you know, even though I don't know what basis or theory of law Rappaport sued Barstool Sports, Dave Portnoy.
Attack of image.
Was it? I don't know. Again, I really don't know.
How you put someone's face on a shirt with herpes, you bet your ass you're getting sued for that.
So
you can't even use a fucking Michael Jordan T-shirt. You can't use his face on anything without his family calling up, be like, hey, we want a piece of that shit.
There's like, you can get away with a lot of things through what's called fair use and parody law. But again, that is not my area of expertise. That is not an area I know. But I know that of things you can use to kind of get around that stuff. But kind of the main crux in a kind of, like, I don't know the exact complaint. And I was saying before, I had a judge who once said, like, there's no statute against being an asshole. Like, there isn't. Like, you can be a dick. Like, you can't be sued for being in that. Again, there's no statute against being an asshole. Yeah, but
you can't ruin somebody's image.
But that's where you get a little bit, like, public figure, you know, used in likeness, like things being used in likeness, parody of.
If I took your face right now and I cropped it and put it on, like, a crop top, but then I had, like, your mouth where the belly button was. And it was very, very sexual. And then I did like, I wrote something on your forehead, like sex addict. You'd be so upset. Anybody would be upset. You're going to sue the shit out of that person for destroying your image and using your likeness.
Oh, no. I could, because I'm not a public figure. Technically, I don't know.
If you're a public figure, I think it even gives you more credit to do so.
No, because as a public figure, and that's the way the law is written, you can use your platform as a public figure to say, that's a stupid t-shirt. I don't have herpes. I know. It's like, I get that. That's my.
Ain't nobody believe anyone that's on a shirt. If it's on a shirt, everybody believes it. That's why there's don't our YOLO shirts. People believe it.
T-shirt law. Write it down. But no, I don't. I'd have to do a little bit of research to look at it, because there is a distinction between a public figure versus a non-public figure, versus, because it's slander and libel. That's probably what he probably sued under, a theory of slander.
Yeah. What about the monk from Rage Against the Machine on that cover album that lit himself on fire with gasoline? The Rage Against the Machine album covers that. Is that likely? I mean, I don't think he really cares because he's not really alive anymore, but.
Then now you're getting into public domain and copyright. That is well in the deep end of things I do not know the answer to.
He did it in front of the public. I think everybody, yeah. Using Stonehenge, anybody can use it because it's old history, it's prehistory, so it's everyone's heritage. It's a collective.
So copyright law and what's called intellectual property, copyright, patents, things like that. That is a very new and very interesting area of law. I actually did want to go into that for a little bit, but they want like a hard science background. And I'm not talking like I took like I minored in biology or chemistry. They want you to have a separate degree or master's degree in some kind of engineering, which I do not have. I did political science and history back at the University of Maine. Go Black Bears. So I did that, but I don't have. I'm interested in science. I like science, but I don't have that type of background. And it's a very interesting kind of area because I think I took a class, a writing class, and the focus was intellectual property. And one of the things that came up was a few years ago, I can't remember exactly when, but a cameraman in like the Amazon or one of like a rainforest in like Southeast Asia, like put their camera down. And a monkey came up to the camera and took a picture with it, took a selfie with it. And that it went over like National Geographic, and like the post went viral. It's a really good picture. I think you can look it up, like monkey, monkey selfie. And hopefully you get the correct one, because that's probably a very dangerous rabbit hole to go down.
I think I've watched a porn called Monkey Selfie.
I didn't want to hear that this early, but one of the things PETA, in their infinite
fuck
terribleness, or some other organization, sued the photographer for copyright because it's not their photo, because they didn't take it, the monkey did. So the monkey should. Yeah. So it was and again, I hate myself for doing this because I do not like PETA or those types of like that organization.
Nobody does. They're not doing any good.
But it's a very interesting, like, well, who does own that photo? Like, if I take a photo.
Jesus owns everything.
Broad scheme, probably God. That is way outside my reference at this
point. Or moment. Evolutionary biology, I don't know.
Yeah, but it was a very interesting, like, theory and thought process. And, I think we each took sides because that's what you do when you're in law school. You practice arguing, you practice writing about, make your argument. Like, why does the cameraman own the photo? Why does the monkey own the photo? And that's one of the things. And I always kind of joke, and it's actually something that Dave brought to my attention to kind of bring it full circle back to him. And the theory they always tell you when you start law school, and then go through it. Like, you're not a person at the end of law school. because the way your mind thinks now is completely different. That, like, you want to talk about, like, I know you had a person about, like, cults on earlier. Like, you want to have them study people going into law school versus people leaving law school, because it completely changes your, like, thought process, the way you think, the way you structure reason.
It's probably like seeing a murder. You just, all the human empathy just gets pulled out of you.
Also, yes, but that's a different that's a different story. But what you, like, I had a friend of mine, oh, actually it was Dave, came up to me like, hey, I know you're a lawyer now, like, I got this question. Like, yeah, sure, what is it? And he starts talking to me about this, like, really complex issue. I'm like, that is not what I do. Like, it was a meme. It's like, oh, cool, you're a lawyer? Yeah, tell me every law. Like, not the game, not what I'm supposed to do. But people will come up to you and, like, they ask you questions. Like, hey, so I felt, and actually, that reminds me of this really funny story. So I used to do trivia years ago. And they, on the my trivia bio, this was before I became an attorney. This was just when I graduated from law school and was working for the bar exam. And they wanted to put expert in bird law on my, like, trivia bio. And I was like, no, I can't do that. I'm like, well, why? It's like an Always Sunny reference, get it? I'm like, you know, I get the reference. I think everyone's going to get the reference. But when you say you're an expert, you have to hold yourself out. It's a standard. You have to be, hold yourself out to be a expert of the, an expert possessing knowledge known outside of standard people of the like. I think that's the standard. So you have to be a, when they say expert in broad law, you actually have to be an expert in avian law. And they're like, you're thinking way too into this. Like, no one's going to make that joke. Like, look, I get it, but I'd rather not sit before a disciplinary committee and have to explain this always. And it's always Sunny reference. Fast forward 2-3 years later, you know, as you know, I passed, I'm practicing now, and a friend of mine comes up, like a friend of a friend comes up to me. Hey, Nick, you're a lawyer, right? Like, yeah, what's up? So I got this question. So I found a bird outside of my house and I want to keep it. And I'm like, do you think I can, like, is that okay? I'm like, you asking me a question about bird law? It's like, yeah, I guess I am. Like, I don't know. I'm not an expert. I have to go make a phone call. Mm-hmm. So I, like, call the guy, like my friend who was, because I told him what just happened. It's like, fuck you, and hang up the phone.
Well, look, Nick, you give me enough of your time, man. I heard your dog barking, so you probably got to.
No. That's, he's fine. Before we kind of depart here, one of the things I actually wanted to come on, didn't even get a chance to talk about it. So definitely time to have me on next time. My blog and my Instagram account, you know, The Drinking Lawyer, talks mostly about, like, you know, craft beer in Rhode Island, Mass, New England, across the country. You know, hopefully, you know, next time we get on, we can get more into the drinking part of the Instagram handle and not the lawyer part. But, you know, it's one of those things, you know, law is such a complex and interesting field, and you could probably do an episode a week just on what's going on in the legal field. But one of the misnomers, and I'm glad I get to at least talk about it a little bit, is the whole, like, lawyers can kind of fib a little bit, you know, when it comes to, like, I mean, fibbing, some do that, which is really unfortunate, like I, you know, kind of described beforehand.
Yep.
But once you're in that box, like I said, that litigation, that discovery box, to know that and to be a part of, because if you're sitting there like, dude, just lie. Like, I can't lie because of this. Like, you have to tell the truth. You have to be honest, and you have to make sure that your position is unscrutable and cannot be attacked in the part of, from the perspective of your lying. But hopefully next time, I'll be on. We'll talk a little bit more about, like, craft beer, different breweries. I've got a blog coming up, hopefully either tomorrow or the next day. My fiance and I, with the dog that you just heard a couple minutes ago, went to a brewery in Westerly called Greysdale Brewing, which is one of my favorite places to go. It's incredibly beautiful. And if you ever visit Rhode Island, and I hope you do, that's a brewery you should definitely visit. It's in Westerly, so it's a little bit far away from the main part of things, but follow me at The Drinking Lawyer on Instagram and www.thedrinkinglawyer.com for all different types of fun things regarding breweries. Not so much about the law, but breweries in general.
We'll hit it next time, but that's why we call it conversation.